From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. 800,000 federal workers missed their first paycheck today as the partial government shutdown drags on. Today, the House of Representatives joined the Senate in passing a measure to pay all federal employees, including furloughed ones, retroactively, and the president is expected to sign it. He's also mulling a declaration of a national emergency to build the wall without Congress's help. Joining us now, NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jeremy. How are you?
I'm doing well. Here we are again. And
yeah,
we're starting
feels like
to
Groundhog Day, doesn't
exactly,
it?
Except that now it feels a little more real since today is the payday and they're not getting paid. And the effects are starting to pile up. There's a story about farmers not getting federal crop payments or the planting information they need because of the government shutdown. A terminal at Miami International Airport is going to shut down this weekend because there aren't enough TSA workers coming into work to keep that terminal open. Is there any sign, Scott, that the president's base is starting to split from him on this?
No, not really, if you're talking about his most enthusiastic supporters. We have a new NPR Ipsos poll out today that shows among Americans in general, three-quarters think that this long-running shutdown is an embarrassment for the country. About 7 in 10 think it's going to do damage to the economy, and it is. But there was a Reuters Ipsos poll out earlier this week, and among Republicans, they found more than three-quarters still want additional border fencing or some sort of border barrier, and more than half think that the government shutdown is a perfectly legitimate means towards that end. So, no, among the president's base, we're not seeing much erosion, even as the sad consequences of this shutdown continue to pile up like trash in a national park trash can.
Which is happening as well. And at this point, how likely is the president to do what he's been threatening to do and declare a national emergency so that the wall can be built with funds that have already been appropriated to other things, and he doesn't need Congress to give him the authority to do it?
Well, it's hard to put odds on the future, especially with this president. He said yesterday that he would probably, maybe, definitely go that route if he can't make a deal with Congress, but he also said he wasn't prepared to take that step just yet. Certainly, invoking emergency powers, which would allow the president to then raid various pots of money to build the wall without explicit congressional authorization would be an audacious step. It would be fraught with political peril. It would surely invite legal challenges. And there are plenty of lawmakers who would be unhappy either because they have a stake in whatever pot of money might be
like
raided
disaster
for that
relief
purpose.
Funds for yeah. certain things, yeah.
Or simply because they don't like to give up, you know, the congressional control of the purse strings. But there's also a grudging sense among some lawmakers that this may be the only sort of face-saving off-ramp from this situation where there's been very little sign of compromise.
Meanwhile, what is happening in Congress? The House of Representatives, controlled by the Democrats now, keeps passing bills to reopen shuttered agencies, but it doesn't seem like those are going anywhere in the Senate, and are negotiations still taking place?
You know, while you mentioned that both houses have now passed a bill to ensure that federal workers get back pay if and when this shutdown ever ends, mm-hmm. that's pretty much all they've been able to agree on. And now we've had both houses recess for the weekend, so we can basically guarantee that this shutdown will stretch into tomorrow, making it the longest in history. No, there don't appear to be negotiations going on. There were some sort of nascent talks yesterday on the Senate side between moderate Republicans and others, but they quickly broke down and evaporated. And we had Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, who's often an ally of the White House, basically throwing up his hands and saying, okay, I guess we're going to have to go the emergency declaration mm-hmm. route.
Meanwhile, Scott, big news in the Russia investigation, I guess the broader Russia investigation, and that is that former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen will testify publicly before Congress next month. What is your sense of the White House worry about that and what Cohen is likely to be questioned about and talk about?
The president was asked about this yesterday while he was down at the border in Texas, and he sort of brushed off the question, saying he's not concerned about it at all. It was, I think, his shortest answer he gave during a lengthy back and forth with reporters. I'm not sure that that's true that he's not at all concerned. We do expect that Michael Cohen's going to be pretty circumspect in the open hearing about what he has to say specifically around the Russia investigation and the special counsel's investigation. He's probably going to talk mostly about how he misrepresented his own communications with Russia over a future Trump building and whether that that misstatement that he made, his lie to Congress, was somehow coordinated with anyone, including the president himself.
That is certainly going to be a day that a lot of people are going to be paying attention to what's going on in Washington. Scott Horsley, NPR White House reporter, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, after days of back and forth over President Trump's announcement that all American troops will be coming home from Syria, that process is now underway. A spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition fighting ISIS confirmed the news this morning. The BBC's Martin Patience is following this story, and he joins us now from Beirut. Martin, what does this mean? Is this a full-scale drawdown?
The reality is we simply don't know. What we've been told by a U.S. military spokesman is that the withdrawal has started. According to one report, 10 American armored cars left Syria for Iraq. America still has troops stationed inside Iraq. But how quickly the troops will come out, we simply don't know. Initially, Donald Trump, he said all the troops would be out within a matter of weeks. Now that process has slowed down. There is confusion within ranks, and here in the Middle East, many believe that the American policy in Syria is an absolute shambles.
Well, part of the reason there's this confusion is last weekend, National Security Advisor John Bolton said that this withdrawal would not begin until Turkey had promised that it wouldn't attack the Kurds in northern Syria. Now, the Kurds have been helping U.S. troops fight ISIS, but Turkey sees the Kurds as a national security threat. Bolton left Ankara without getting that promise. Does it appear that the administration is on the same page?
From Turkey's point of view, the YPG, the Kurdish militia, who fought alongside the Americans to defeat so-called Islamic State or certainly crush their physical caliphate, they are viewed by Turkey as terrorists. Now, we know that John Bolton has been trying to get assurances from Turkey over this matter, but he was snubbed by the Turkish president. They were absolutely furious that America was trying to extract these sort of assurances. So that issue has not been resolved, and I think that's one of the main sticking points when you speak to analysts. They will say America does want to seek some kind of protection for the Kurds inside Syria, but Turkey, which let's not forget is also a member of NATO, which America's a member of as well, Turkey is simply not going to give those assurances. So it's very difficult to see how you actually resolve that.
I know you've been speaking to the Kurds in northern Syria. How worried are they about that attack that Turkey promised it would carry out?
Well, they're deeply worried. They feel in many ways that they've been betrayed by America. They fought alongside American troops. 10,000 Kurdish fighters, according to some estimates, lost their lives in the fight against the so-called Islamic State. So there's a great deal of, I think, uncertainty there, confusion, a bit of anger, because they are worried that as soon as America moves out, Turkey could well move in. And that's what Ankara, Turkey, has been threatening to do.
And that appears to be starting now. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was in Cairo yesterday. He's been trying to reassure U.S. allies in the Middle East. Here's part of what he said.
President Trump has made the decision to bring our troops home from Syria. But this isn't a change of mission. We remain committed to the complete dismantling of ISIS, the ISIS threat, and the ongoing fight against radical Islamism in all of its forms.
Again, President Trump, when he made this announcement back in December, said that ISIS had been completely defeated. So how is this resonating in the region? Do American allies trust Pompeo and what's coming out of the administration?
Well, first of all, ISIS haven't been completely defeated. Yes, their physical caliphate has shrunk to about 1% of the territory they once held. Their backs are against the wall, but according to some estimates, they've still got thousands of fighters. And if American troops do pull out, the argument is that ISIS could actually revive itself. That is one of the chief concerns of allies as well as some American officials, that ISIS could well make a comeback. Second of all, in terms of what countries in the region think of American actions. They were completely stunned when Donald Trump sent out this tweet saying that the troops would be withdrawn. And they are, I think, scratching their heads, waiting to see what happens, what America will actually do in order to formulate their own plans. Because some will argue if America pulls out, what it does is it creates a vacuum and a very complicated battlefield in Syria. And many countries will rush to fill that vacuum that America leaves.
From what you can see, does the U.S. have a plan if ISIS does become resurgent?
It's very difficult to see how you fight ISIS in Syria if you're not there. Yes, they do have a presence on the Iraqi border, but without boots on the ground, allies on the ground, it's very difficult to see how America could possibly fight ISIS without a presence in the country.
That's the BBC's Martin Patience in Beirut. Martin, thanks very much.
Thank you.
A former inmate in Illinois is suing the state for putting him into solitary confinement for more than two decades. Anthony Gay went to prison in 1994 on a robbery charge for stealing a dollar bill and a hat. Behavior problems added to his sentence, and by the time he was released last August, he'd spent 22 years in isolation. His lawyers say that pushed him to the edge of insanity. Anthony Gay is here with us now, and a warning, this conversation at times will be graphic. Anthony, welcome. You say in the lawsuit that isolation was torture. What were those 22 years like?
I was trapped in a cell 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Time descended like the lid of a coffin. My cell was smaller than the size of a parking space or a small bathroom. On many occasions, I would be isolated on a wing by myself in a cold, freezing cell or strapped down in six-point restraints. I would be punished for cutting on myself and given an unappetizing diet called meal loaf that looked like feces and tastes like dog food to punish me for cutting on myself.
In fact, you mutilated yourself. You used pieces of metal to slice into your neck, into your arms. You cut off parts of your genitals. How did that begin?
I transferred to TAM Supermax in March of 1998, and I was put in a cell where the window was up high and it was hard to see out of, and I couldn't endure it. I just started cutting on myself to be able to get out the cell. And at first I used to do like superficial cuts, and they didn't take me serious.
And how would you do that? How would you get the device or the metal or whatever it was that you used to cut yourself?
Sometimes, like, I might get some mail. It might be a staple in it or...
A staple.
Or I might find a piece of rock in the cell somewhere or an ink pen and sharpen it up.
And you would do that because you wanted to get the attention of people. You wanted the guards to notice you. You wanted the nurses to rush into your cell so that they would tend to you, so that they would touch you. I mean, is that what that was, that you were just seeking some sort of human interaction and human touch?
Exactly. I wanted to know that I was human. I wanted to feel alive, and that's what the only means I could do it.
And when they came in, how did it feel?
It made me feel alive, because the nurses were very caring, compassionate. They were like, clean the blood off me, encourage me not to do it.
Did you consider suicide at any point?
Yeah, on occasion I did, like the time I cut my neck.
This happened over the course of many years. You were moved from prison to prison, and you were not a model prisoner. You got into fights. You attacked guards. Of course, that would extend your periods in isolation. What would you say to people who are hearing this and this terrible story and thinking, well, if you had behaved yourself, this wouldn't have happened to you?
I think that's misleading. I wasn't doing it so much to hurt people. I was doing it so I could actually get out and have contact with people. For example, like now, I'm out here in society and I'm free. I don't just run around attacking people, jumping on people, putting my hands on people, throwing things on people. I'm acting like a human would. under human conditions, under civilized conditions.
At any point did you get the mental health care that you presumably needed so badly? Did anybody intervene and get you in front of a psychiatrist so that you could get any kind of help?
I mean, that's a difficult question to answer because at the end of the day, whatever treatment that they did give me was never sufficient.
And what kind of treatment did they give you?
Like cell front. They'll talk to me at the cell front, or they might see me once a week.
No one ever took you from that cell and put you in a psychiatric hospital, for instance.
Exactly.
Right. I want to bring in your lawyer now, Alexis Garmi Chardon. Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay.
Hi, Peter.
Well, this is just a terrible story. Thank you for speaking with us. How did Anthony's story come to the attention of you and other lawyers?
I met Anthony and first heard about him only after he got released from prison, which was back in August. By that time, however, there'd been a lot of other attorneys working both in the criminal system and the civil system who were working on Anthony's behalf. Anthony, at one point, was sentenced to over 90 years in prison, and with, it's a bit confusing, but with 152 of those years to be served in solitary confinement as administrative punishments for violations he committed while in IDOC.
And can you explain that? Because I think that that is a fundamental part of this story. He went into prison on this robbery charge for stealing a dollar bill and a hat, but then the punishment kept getting stacked up and stacked up and stacked up. How did he go from that first charge to 22 years in isolation?
That's right. And I think Anthony's, this story illustrates how prison can be a real trap for mentally ill. Anthony went in after, that's true, being convicted of stealing a hat and a dollar bill in a street fight with a man who had insulted his sister. He actually was given parole, then drove without a license and finds himself incarcerated in IDOC in his early 20s with a 7-year sentence. He could have gotten out in 3.5 years. Unfortunately, Anthony had some disciplinary infractions. He didn't get the good time, and he ended up in solitary confinement after one of those disciplinary infractions. And from there, he rapidly began to decompensate. Solitary confinement is known to ravage people's minds.
But it took 22 years before a judge recognized that was happening with Anthony, intervened, and then eventually let him out of prison in August. How did you get a judge to empathize with what was happening?
So because of manifestations of his mental illness while he was in solitary confinement, he ended up getting referred by corrections officers for infractions such as throwing urine or feces at an officer. He'd get referred to the state prosecutor, and the state prosecutor racked up those charges and brought 22 successive criminal cases against Anthony. Eventually, over a decade later, the state appellate defender found his case, wrote some powerful briefs on his behalf, and at the end of the day, it wasn't a judge who had the power to overturn those convictions, but it was state prosecutors who recognized the injustice of what had happened and were willing to negotiate with Anthony's criminal defense attorneys to reduce his sentence. Even after he knew he was going to get out, he was still in solitary confinement.
Well, he can't be the only one who's going through this. Many states, as you know, are trying to make changes to their prison isolation policies, but the issue is still there. I mean, by some estimates, there are more than 80,000 inmates across this country that are in isolation, spending up to 22 hours a day alone. According to the Chicago Tribune, which has reported on this story, of 1,100 inmates in Illinois who are in solitary, 900 of them have been diagnosed with mental illness. I mean, should we just assume that Anthony Gay is not the only person doing grave harm to himself or herself in isolation?
Yeah, we should assume that. And we don't actually just need to take it on assumption. There's a lawsuit going through the courts right now which is challenging the mental health care being provided to prisoners in Illinois. And Anthony was actually a witness in a hearing in that lawsuit just recently. And the judge just last October declared that the level of mental health care being provided to these people is constitutionally inadequate. As you mentioned, other states have begun to adopt rules that would prevent what happened to Anthony from happening again. In Colorado, for example, they have banned the use of solitary for periods longer than 15 days at a time. And they've also banned the use of solitary confinement ever when it comes to a person who is diagnosed as mentally ill. Since they've done that, they've had a decrease in assaults and other problems. And of course, it's a lot less expensive.
Anthony, as terrible as all of this is, there is good news here, which is that you are now a free man. I'm sure you never thought that day was coming as you spent those 22 years in isolation. So tell me about that day that you stepped out of prison and you walked home to see your family back in August.
I think the greatest thing about that day was, prior to all this, my niece Ariana had wrote me a letter and told me that her sister had told her that I had life in prison and that she thought it was sad. When they came to pick me up, I was actually able to give her a hug and tell her I don't believe everything she hear. And then to go home and hug my mom and my father, it was just like unbelievable. But I am here, and it's awesome to be free.
Are you working? Are you getting therapy? What's your life like?
I haven't been able to work yet, but I am getting therapy on a regular basis. We discuss my history and moving forward and trying to make something good out of something bad.
Because you have scars, Anthony. I mean, not only the physical scars all over your body from the self-mutilation, but the scars on the inside. I mean, do you think that you can recover from something like this?
I think Gandhi said it best when he said, the only way to find yourself is to lose yourself in the service of others. So I'm trying not to focus on my scars, but focus on those that's left behind and try to throw them a lifeline to help pull them out the ditch.
Have you hurt yourself since you've gotten out of prison?
No, sir.
Good for you. Anthony Gay, now a free man after spending 22 years in solitary confinement. Best of luck to you.
Thanks.
And your lawyer, Alexis Garmi Chardon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for having us, Peter, and helping Anthony tell his story.
We reached out to the Illinois Department of Corrections. We did not hear back.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The Republican Party of Tarrant County, Texas, has voted to allow the group's vice chairman, Shahid Shafi, to keep his job. Shafi is Muslim, and he has support from high-profile Republicans like Senator Ted Cruz and Governor Greg Abbott, but other local Republicans wanted him ousted because of his religion. Here's Shafi last night.
With today's vote, we have taken a stand against bigotry of all kinds, and we have taken a stand that we will protect and defend our Constitution.
Joining us now is Bud Kennedy, columnist for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Bud, this was a vote of 139 in favor of Shafi to 49 against him. It's not just a couple people who voted against him, maybe because of his religion.
There is a substantial block of precinct chairs. Some are various fringe groups, and then some are old-line Christian conservatives. Pat Robertson told them 20 years ago that the leaders should only be Christians, and they still believe that. A lot of the evangelical community today says that only God-fearing people should be leaders. They've softened that, but some of these still believe that only Christians should be in elected office.
Well, one of the county's Republicans who didn't want Shafi in his position is Dory O'Brien. She wrote on Facebook in December, quote, "We don't think he's suitable as a practicing Muslim to be vice chair because he'd be the representative for all Republicans in Tarrant County, and not all Republicans in Tarrant County think Islam is safe or acceptable in the U.S." What was the reaction there to this effort to remove Shafi and to the eventual victory for him?
Dory and the work she's done here have been a part of the party for a long time. She has been a jihad conspiracist, believing that any Muslim is going to conduct a jihad at any time and that no Muslim should be involved. She's somebody that the party has dealt with, tried to keep at arm's length at times, Over the last 8 or 10 years, she's occasionally spoken at Republican clubs. There is a faction in the party that's very suspicious of all Muslims because they believe in this stealth jihad.
But interestingly, some of the big high-profile Republicans in the state, as we said, Ted Cruz, Greg Abbott, came out and said, no, we're for this guy.
This was the drastic change, and this was, I think, a change for the Republican Party in general, is what happened here, that there was so much broad support for someone who was elected 6 years ago to a local city council. Dr. Shafi endured anti-Muslim campaigns, running for local office, was reelected, showed himself to be a popular conservative, and they had all met Dr. Shafi and worked with him, and they believe him to be a fiscal conservative who should have a place in the Republican Party. So he gained widespread support, and the efforts of a few people to raise suspicion didn't pan out this time. It's really a new day.
You wonder if at any point Dr. Shafi said to himself, you know, they don't want me, I don't want them.
Dr. Shafi has said over and over that he is a conservative, and other Muslim professionals, a large community here in Dallas-Fort Worth, a medical community, professional community, scientific community, business community, want to be Republicans. Dr. Shafi was considered, everyone was looking to Dr. Shafi to see if the Republican Party would accept him. He's a social conservative. He's a fiscal conservative. He came to them and said, I want to be a Republican. Will you let me? And they made him a vice chair of the county party.
That is Bud Kennedy, columnist for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
...2018 ended with some wild swings on Wall Street, and it was the worst year for global markets since the financial crisis began in 2008. China's growth is slowing down. Its trade dispute with the United States may undermine economic growth here and in Europe. German stocks are in bear territory. France is roiled by economic protests. And then there's Brexit. Let's take a look at the sagging global economy. Mohamed El Arian is chief economic advisor of Allianz. Mohamed, good to have you back.
Wonderful to be with you.
Let's start with Europe and the biggest economy on the continent, Germany. Industrial production fell unexpectedly in November. What's the diagnosis for Germany?
Germany is weakening. The rather worrisome measure you just cited came on the back of a negative GDP growth in the third quarter. Most people were willing to dismiss that number when it was released as an outlier. But I think now the evidence is building that not only is Germany slowing, but it could even flirt with a recession, which would be bad news for Europe as a whole.
And what's behind that? Is it the automotive sector which is slowing down and is also a big part of the German economy?
So the immediate reason is what you cited, and in particular, the fact that foreign demand has weakened. But there's a bigger issue, and that's true not only for Germany, but it's true for most of Europe. Because of various factors, mainly political, there have been no meaningful pro-growth measures implemented in the last few years. Germany is going through a fundamental political transition. Mrs. Merkel is handing off to a new generation. And during that handoff, the pro-growth policies have taken a back seat. And that would be fine if the rest of Europe wasn't also slowing, if we didn't have Brexit uncertainty in Britain, if China wasn't also slowing. So this political handoff has come at a tricky time for most economies outside of the United States.
And if Germany is on the brink of a recession, as you say, what does that mean for the entire Eurozone? It's the biggest economy on the continent.
It's not only the biggest economy on the continent, the powerhouse, if you like. It is also the natural leader. I think of it simply as a sports team. And that sports team has two issues, two challenges. The first is the power players are all suffering. It's not just Germany. If you look at the top five economies in Europe, they're all having issues. And secondly, the team as a whole is not playing as a team as a whole. So I worry about Europe.
Well, another one of those big players on the continent is Italy, a country that's loaded up with debt, and now there's a controversy going on about what to do with a big failing bank. How concerned are you about Italy?
My biggest concern about Italy is and has been economic growth. They haven't been able to generate economic growth for quite a while. Per capita income has basically stagnated. And the longer that happens, the more deeply embedded it gets into the structure of the economy. And that matters when you have high debt, like you said. So the big issue for Italy has been and remains economic growth. And the hope had been that the new government coming in on the wave of the anti-establishment feeling that has hit a lot of advanced economies.
Right, and this is the populist five-star movement.
Correct. In coalition. And they made it very clear that they intended to break the mold and they intended to go forward on pro-growth policies. Unfortunately, the way that they want to spend extra money is not as pro-growth as it should be and could be. And as long as growth remains stagnant, you start worrying about debt, you start worrying about the banks, and you start worrying actually about the politics of anger.
Now, you've hinted at the issue of Brexit and what that might mean for Europe. The United Kingdom is trying to withdraw from the European Union, but there is still no deal in place. We're getting closer and closer to the deadline at the end of March. How much turmoil could a no-deal Brexit bring to the economies of Europe? Could that tip everything into a recession?
I don't think it could tip everything into recession, but what it basically does is distract attention from what needs to be done. That's particularly true in the UK. There's been virtually no ability to focus on pro-growth measures because everybody's so focused on Brexit issues. In terms of what happens, I think where we got the debate wrong initially is that everybody was focusing, would it be a hard Brexit or would it be a soft Brexit? As it turned out, that's the wrong debate until now. The issue has been, would it be a fast Brexit versus a slow Brexit? And it has been a slow Brexit. The good news of a slow Brexit is that institutions and banks in particular can adjust and have adjusted. The bad news is it paralyzes everything else. Mm.
Okay, so those are developed countries in Europe. Let's shift now to developing countries because there are problems there too. Brazil, the largest economy in South America, still recovering from a recession in 2015 and 2016. It's got a bloated pension system. These problems helped lead to the recent election of another nationalist far-right government, President Jair Bolsonaro. What kind of trouble does Brazil find itself in?
The big phrase that is used over and over again is Brazil is the economy of tomorrow, always has been, always will be, because Brazil has massive potential. And if that potential is unleashed, then Brazil can completely transform itself. Now, there was a period where Brazil was able to unleash its growth potential. And if you see what it achieved between 2002 and 2008, it was remarkable. And then the global financial crisis came, and then it had its own political issues. We shall see what the new president decides to do. There's nothing inherently problematic about the Brazilian economy. It's about managing the Brazilian economy, and in particular, unleashing its engines.
And investors are looking forward to this new president because Forbes is reporting this week that Brazil is on track to be the best performing stock market in the world in the first quarter because people are hopeful that he'll be able to make a difference there in Brazil's economy. Now, the elephant, of course, in the room for developing countries is China and its slowdown, its trade war with the United States. And from what you're sort of telling me throughout the course of this conversation, it sounds like that issue is sort of underlying a lot of the other problems that we're seeing in economies around the world.
So China is the world's second largest economy, so it does matter. China also is changing the rules of the global economy in many aspects. So yes, China matters a great deal, and what happens in China will be felt in many, many parts of the world. When you think of China, it's really important to remember that it is trying to navigate the trickiest of all developmental transition, which is called the middle-income transition. When you go from being a teenager, if you like, to being an adult with mature economic relationships, more stable institutions, etc., very few countries have been able to navigate this transition, and none have been as large or as complicated as China. So this is an inherently difficult transition. Hmm. Now, China had been navigating it rather well by using the global markets to facilitate all the domestic adjustments you need to make. In the last few years, the global economy has turned less accommodating to that equation.
Hmm. Well, just to wrap this up, because we can't stop in every country around the globe, but there are also headwinds in Japan. Russia is feeling the result of sanctions. What economy have we not been talking about that you think might have a major role in the global economy this year?
So we haven't talked about the United States. And it's fascinating because if you look at the last 12 months, the global growth narrative has changed quite a bit. 12 months ago, the most common cited phrase about global growth was synchronized pickup, this notion that all the countries we cited were picking up at the same time. What people didn't realize at the time was that the underpinnings for that synchronized pickup were actually very weak. So we move from this synchronized pickup to divergence. The U.S. continuing to outpace the rest of the world. The U.S. accelerating at a time when Europe, China, Japan were slowing. And now the focus is on convergence. Will the U.S. pull everybody else up, or will the U.S. be pulled down by the gravity of a slower global economy?
That's Mohammed El Arian, Chief Economic Advisor of Allianz. Mohammed, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you're ready for a new TV show to watch, NPR TV critic Eric Deggans is here with some recommendations. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Okay, so it's a big year for HBO. Game of Thrones is coming to a close, but the network is also bringing back tentpole shows like True Detective. You thought the last season of True Detective was a bit rocky. What do you think of the new one?
Well, I wasn't the only one. Just about every critic of any repute did not like the second season of True Detective. Which kind of went off the rails a little bit. The first one took TV by storm. You know, you remember Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson played partners who were investigating this bizarre crime. And now we have Mahershala Ali. He's playing this unique character. We see him in 1980 when he's starting to investigate a crime where one kid has died and another kid has disappeared. We see him in 1990 where he's kind of been punished for not having solved the crime and finds a way to reinvestigate it. And then we see him in 2015 where he's older and he's suffering from dementia, but he still has an idea about how to go after this case and solve it. It's a compelling story. It's very layered. But the core of the story is really Mahershala Ali's performance. He is so authentic and believable as this character who is a different kind of black man on television.
What a career he's had over the last several years. I hadn't even heard of him until House of Cards a few years ago. And now he seems to be in everything on the small screen and the big screen.
Yeah, he's one of those guys. And you know, it's interesting. Apparently, and he's told this story many times, apparently he went in to audition for the partner character and convinced the producers of the show to make him the lead character. And it just shows that he has realized that his time has come in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, fresh off of winning a Golden Globe for Green Book, now we're going to see him in this TV show.
Another show that caught your eye, National Geographic's Valley of the Boom. This blends documentary and scripted scenes about early Silicon Valley tycoons. Here's what that sounds like.
My name is Darren. I'm an investment banker. In the mid-90s, Wall Street has finally got a new favorite supermodel. Silicon Valley.
One word, Netscape.
Netscape?
They have zero concept of what Netscape is.
They don't even know what the internet is.
Okay, let me break it down for you in the simplest of terms.
This is the beginning of what they called the browser wars.
Okay, so what stands out to you about Valley of the Boom?
So that's a montage of different characters from this show, which tells the story of how Silicon Valley basically came to exist. And it does that by following a few important threads. One of them is what is called the browser wars, the war between a company called Netscape and Microsoft's Internet Explorer. Nat Geo does an interesting thing where they interview the actual people who were involved in this situation when it happened, but then they also hire actors to play these people. So you can really get a sense that, you know, what they're showing you is what actually happened because the people who were there sort of co-signed all the dramatic scenes that you see.
Mm-hmm. Better than Silicon Valley?
It's different. Silicon Valley is a comedy.
Right.
This is much more of a drama. I think what this is about is for people who can't remember what it was like when an iPhone didn't exist. This will remind you and educate you, if you weren't alive at that time, about what it was like when the internet first began to emerge as a commercial force in America. You know, we've forgotten what all of that was like because we live in a world where all this infrastructure is surrounding us. And so this is a good reminder of how all that stuff came to be.
Well, I once used Telnet and the precursor to Netscape, which was NCSA Mosaic. So take that. Okay, let's get to the next
one.
I used to
be on CompuServe. Okay.
Oh yeah, CompuServe. Good. Prodigy. Okay. Star Trek Discovery returns to CBS. Eric, this show tried at once to continue the legacy of Star Trek while setting itself apart in its first season. Does it continue to break the mold in the new one?
Yeah, and that's always a delicate balance. And in this season, people who are Trek fans will see that they are going to present Spock. Now, Mr. Spock, according to Discovery, this new show, is actually the adopted brother of the lead character, Michael Burnham. So one of the questions that I think Trek fans had when Discovery first debuted is, how come we never heard about this character, even though Spock and Star Trek have been around for 50 years? So Discovery's task during the second season is going to be to explain that.
Finally, Eric, Showtime debuts its new series Black Monday this month. It stars Don Cheadle as an African-American Wall Street trader back in the 80s. What do you think of this one?
This is a really fun and gritty series. Don Cheadle is playing this guy who's kind of a huckster and kind of a player, but he has big dreams and he wants to make mega millions off of the stock market. He has an established firm, but he's trying to play with the big trading houses. And it's the story of how he uses sort of street smarts and his own ego to try and compete with these guys. And he's quite a character. He's very flashy. It's a fun reminder of the go-go 80s. I really loved it. And you can see the first episode of it on YouTube, so people can watch the first episode right now.
That is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans with some of his picks for 2019, the shows to come. Eric, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And a farewell today to our digital producer, Jackson Code, who's heading back to school for one last semester. Hope we'll see you back here. Jackson, thank you for everything. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.